Good evening and welcome to the second presentation in this our ninth series of talks on Kentucky Live, Southern Culture at its Best, sponsored by the Friends of WKU Libraries and the Kentucky Museum. My name is Brian Coots, and as head of the Department of Library Public Services, I coordinate this series with my colleague in the white back there, Peggy Wright, and with help from Haiwong Wan, our website master, and Brian Carson, our reference coordinator. Daniel Peach and Christopher McConnell designed our posters, and our technical specialist tonight is Daniel Pauly. Our speaker tonight is a native of Bowling Green and Warren County, where his family has lived since the early 19th century. Growing up, he attended city schools and wanted to be a soldier and fight Hitler in Tojo. He was influenced by his parents and his teachers, especially those at Bowling Green High School. After high school, he enrolled at Center College and spent his sophomore year at WKU before graduating from Center with a degree in business. Following a stint in the Marines and a hitch as a reporter for the Bowling Green Daily News, he enrolled at Vanderbilt Law School, graduating in 1964, and then practiced law in South Central Kentucky for some four decades. Some 8 years ago, Robert and his wife retired to St. Augustine, Florida, where he now spends his time when he's not visiting his children who are scattered in Kentucky, Florida, New Orleans, Chicago, and New York City. In 2009, he published Charles Garvin's Dynasty of Dimes on the history of Beach Bend Park and its lovingly eccentric owner, Charles Garvin. His latest book, published in March of this year, is entitled Greyhound to Vegas, The Odyssey of Hilda Reynolds Krause, and tells the story of one of Bowling Green's most fascinating former residents. It's a great pleasure to welcome Bob Dickey.
Thank you, Brian. Before I get started, I've got to comment on this flyer that you put out, postcard. I thought it was very well done. I was in pretty fast company. Somebody is going to be on your program that writes cookbooks, and they are always box office successes. And then there's, regardless of how many Nobel Prize winners Bowling Green High and Western turn out, we're the Corvette City, and that's what we're known for. It says the Corvettes in literature, so they're in everything. I will say this, I could have saved you some time on this September. Let's see, it's already been Georgia after the collapse of the Soviet Union. Now, I just drove through South Georgia, and they just don't give a darn about the Russians as long as they stay out. So they had a problem with Sherman, but since then, they've done pretty well. Then there was something about Gabon in Africa. If there are diamonds there, my wife would have been interested in those. And something about the Peace Corps, and they probably could do some good in East Kentucky, too. So anyway, I thought that was very well done. And there's Hilda in a Greyhound bus, a more modern variety than what she dealt with. I'm delighted to be here. I warn you in advance, what you see is what you get. My good friend Carol Hildreth would say that some things defy polishing, and so you won't see a lot of polish up here. Practicing law, you didn't have this kind of problem, because if you were talking to a jury, you had an idea about who they were and where they came from, and also the kind of message you wanted to deliver. Same way with a history professor. There's some people in there that are really interested in history, and others wanting just to get through the day and get the credits, but you know the kind of message that you want to give them. Now, this audience is a challenge, and it's not your fault. Who shows up and what your interests are, it's anybody's guess. Sometimes nobody shows up. I did one of these things in Glasgow, and they had a thunderstorm, and there was one person that showed up. Anyway, be on the safe side, the broad topic is Greyhound to Vegas. And the heroine is Hilda, and she was something else. She didn't ride any Greyhound bus into Las Vegas. She went by Cadillac. But the title to the book is really not misleading, because her tremendous success as a person and a businesswoman, before there weren't very many businesswomen in this neck of the woods, it just started at the bus depot, the Greyhound Depot in Bowling Green, Kentucky, on Main Street between Center Street and Fountain Square. The building is gone now. So there's the Greyhound she started riding and finally got to Vegas. You see, I'm never without my notes, practicing law or anything else. I was always afraid I would forget something important. So I'll be referring to these notes, and I'll try not to stick my head in them too much. Same way with books and programs like this. Hilda's journey began in West Virginia, and she took an 18-hour train ride from Elkins, West Virginia, to Bowling Green to attend the Bowling Green Business University. Now, she was interested from the time she was in the first grade, we don't know, but she was interested in a career in business. And the kind of education she wanted was simply not available in Elkins, West Virginia, much less Montez, West Virginia, where she did most of her growing up. So if this was an audience composed of, what's the club, the business and professional women, that's a good spot to jump off on her business success. It was a very modest cafe to begin with in the Bowling Green bus station. Then she picked up another bus station cafe in Hopkinsville. And then she made quite a jump in 1950 when she opened Cave Acres at Cave City. After that, it gets really phenomenal. Think of the culture shock. This West Virginia, highly intelligent young lady, gets educated in Bowling Green and has business success in Bowling Green. And then she ends up running the dining room and the food services at the Hotel and Casino de Capri in Havana, Cuba. The roulette wheels were turning. Then, on top of that, after a couple of memorable encounters with Fidel Castro, she becomes a founder of one of American icons, I guess, Caesar's Palace in Las Vegas. It's a story how she got to that stage. Her first marriage ended in a divorce about 1935. Probably part of the problem was that she had become the major breadwinner in the family. Lots of strain, and anyway, they parted company. She raised her only son, her only child, Charles H. Reynolds, the late Justice Charles H. Reynolds, while running this restaurant business, and she crowded, 25 or 26 hours into a 24-hour day to do that. 1943, after being a single mother and running the business for about 8 years, she married a soldier boy. She met him in the Hopkinsville Cafe. He was stationed at Fort Campbell at that time in the middle of World War II. And his name was Marvin Krause. Now, turns out that Marvin was a professional man. She didn't know it at the time, but he was a professional gambler. Made his living gambling when he wasn't serving the U.S. Army. And through his, quote, connections, this is how Hilda Reynolds got into the casino business big time. The connections were in Miami, and they were, no question about it, those enterprising members of the mob were setting up Havana as the new playground of the Western Hemisphere. And no question about it, that was an opportunity that Hilda took, and that's how she came to have a ownership interest as well as management of the food services in the hotel and Casino de Capri. You can see where you start to parlay what I like to refer to as mashed potato money from the bus station and from Cave Acres, and you parlay that into an interest in casinos, international trade, whatever. So that should satisfy the business and professional women. She had a great deal of success. If we were here as a part of a creative writing class on the Hill or at Bowling Green High, Warren Central, I think they read and write out there too. You could start there with back to my college days. Girlfriend at Center College. We were under the influence of Hemingway. All we wanted to do was move to Paris and live on the left bank and write novels. And of course that didn't come to pass. And creative writing, I'll have to say this, I had in college some good English teachers, but I think I learned all I will ever need to know about writing a simple declaratory sentence and making myself understood on paper from Miss Bell Potter at Bowling Green High School. She knew what she was doing. I had a history professor at Center, Dr. Frank Heck, of German extraction, and he was very precise, German-style precision. He taught me a whole lot about research and being accurate at what you're doing. And that leads to a funny thing that happened to me on the way to getting this book published. Against all the advice I ever had, I did make one trip to New York City. They said there was an agent up there that was very interested in the book. Met with her and met with the editor and so forth. Making a long story short, they said they liked the book, liked the story and everything, but the editor said, just not enough dialogue. I said, well, my heroine expired in 1974. We can't ask her to comment on anything. And most all of her generation, same way. There is some family. I've talked to all of them. And I have got every single quote in the whole world that I have heard and recorded. And the editor laughed and said, oh, I believe we can take care of that, you know. We can add a little here, a little there. And I waited, you know, I finished the meeting with them, but that's when I decided that, no, that just wasn't for me. I didn't have enough, really, imagination to write fictional stuff, and I wasn't going to try to fictionalize a story that was I felt was good on its own two feet. I could also tell, maybe this is a confession to laziness or something. I could tell the creative writing class that I don't believe Well, this is the third book I've done, and I don't believe I would have even gotten through the first one without this darn computer, despite all the warts it's got and everything. One of my favorite fictional authors is Pat Conroy, South Carolina. You know, the Prince of Tides and the Lords of Discipline and the Great Santini, The Water is Wide. He takes a yellow pad like this and a pencil and he writes it out longhand. And I haven't got the physical stamina or the guts to do that. And without that computer, and I cuss it occasionally, but I couldn't have done it. And you know, regardless of when you start out on these things, there's always, at least you feel some urgency about it. You're thinking about maybe another project, and you're hoping to get the book done in, you know, 12 to 18 months. That's about as quick as I've ever done one. Then I thought about addressing the psychology club, the anthropology club, something like that. All those ologies I get mixed up sometimes. But here is Hilda, the country girl from West Virginia, but well educated in Bowling Green, and sharp as she could be, and she's rubbing shoulders with the likes of Myron Lansky of the Mob. They say that if he had been straight, one of the greatest minds as far as finance, being a financier, that there ever was. He knew his dollars and cents. And I don't know, Hilda probably corrected one or two of his balance sheets while she was in Cuba. So that's dealing with those kind of folks, that's a pretty good culture shock. You know, she grew up in a lumber camp in West Virginia. Now, we went over there and tried to find Montez, M-O-N-T-E-S. We tried to find Montez, West Virginia. The mountains are still there. The trees have grown back. But we couldn't get there from here or any other place. The bottom line is that there was never a road cut into Montez, West Virginia. It was just too mountainous. The only way that Hilda and her family could get in and out of that community, which was mainly a great big sawmill and the company store that her mother ran, the only way to get in was a railroad, and her daddy built the railroad in and maintained it. Anyway, she never, whether she was dealing with the backwoods in West Virginia or customers at Cave City or Bowling Green and her restaurants, she never seemed to lose her balance, never forgot who she was and where she was going. Now, Fidel Castro had a great deal of respect for this lady, and here he is, you know, the communist revolutionary, and he's looking, no, it wasn't he looking her. She was looking him straight in the eye, the greatest entrepreneur that this town's ever had, you know. And she had a couple of memorable run-ins with Castro, but when she left Cuba, one of the last of the casino crowd to go, she had his respect. We tried to get in touch with Fidel, but he never wrote back, he never called, and we went through diplomatic channels, and then I just finally addressed a letter to Fidel Castro of Havana, Cuba. The letter didn't come back, so maybe he got it, but he never answered it. But we wanted some comments that he would make about Hilda Reynolds Krause. Maybe that's when I could use the editor in New York. Maybe we could have made up some things for Fidel to say. See, senor, she was a great lady, you know, or something. Moving over to the business administration majors, and that's the way of all flesh it was when I was in school. ran out of credits for everything else, so I had to get a business administration major when I would love to have had a history and English majors. You could tell them that we've studied Hilda, and she never overextended herself. She was a businesswoman that was born and bred in the middle of the Great Depression, and maybe we could use some of her advice right now. She saved, conserved, and she was a pay-as-you-go person. She always had a goal, and she always had a method or a plan to get there. It didn't matter whether it was little things or big things. Her problem at the Bowling Green Greyhound bus station always was this. It was on the main line between Louisville and Nashville, and she wanted those buses to stop long enough for people to come in and sit down and eat a meal. A lot of those stops were, you know, restroom stops, 5 minutes and 10 minutes. And that was a real problem, and she always had excellent relations with the Greyhound and did very well keeping up the ties with the drivers themselves, and that helped, because they would cheat a little bit one way or the other and give her some extra minutes there in Bowling Green. But some people in those five-minute stops didn't even get off the bus. So what does she do? Now, she's got her basket, just like gathering eggs out at the farm, you know, where grandmother did it. She has a basket full of eggs and apples, and she goes on the bus. Here's a sandwich, give me a nickel. You know, here's an apple, give me a nickel. And most of those nickels she saved. That's not in the book, and it should have been. So you all know something that nobody else knows. Now, the big things, she found out, you know, Bowling Green is not exactly halfway between Louisville and Nashville. And Greyhound wanted to move their main meal stop more to a halfway position, and you can understand why. So they chose Horse Cave, Kentucky. Well, she could see that that was going to, if not destroy her business, at least cripple it by about 95% for Bowling Green. So what does she do? She doesn't cry about it or anything. She goes up to Cave City, buys a piece of property, then goes to Greyhound and says, "Look, tell you what I'll do. I'll build a building and let me lease you a little space for your bus station in my cafeteria and restaurant." And that's what she did, Cave Acres, which was on the leading edge. You know, but, this part of Kentucky, we're not, what does Rush Limbaugh say? We're not on the societal cutting edge of anything, you know. We usually sort of lag behind. But she put in the most modern cafeteria, dining room, and the kind of thing, and always turned out the good food. People would come from Bowling Green, Glasgow, there for Sunday dinner. And if you had a deposition in Louisville, you always timed it where you would at least eat at least one meal at Cave Acres. So anyway, she just reversed the charges on Greyhound. She had rented from them at Hopkinsville, rented from them at Bowling Green, and so after that at Cave Acres, Greyhound rented from her. It's a real natural, if you're going to talk to the girls and boys club and try to give them a good rah-rah speech, because this is a female Horatio Alger. Now, she never was, it's not exactly a rags to riches, because she was never in rags. She had a good substantial family behind her, and they had the resources to send her to Bowling Green to get educated. But there wasn't any silver spoon either. Her parents were really hard-working folks, and besides running the company store at Montez, her mother was also a midwife. There's a funny story in the book about that. Anyway, I've talked to members of her family, Mike Reynolds, his mother, different people. And everybody marvels at her work ethic. And that work ethic that it had to start developing back in the mountains, and she just continued to build on it. Also, the feeling of independence that she always had, a lot of it by necessity, of course, but she had a mountain lady's independence. I don't think she would understand the women's liberation movement at all, because she did her own liberating, you understand. But she was that rare businesswoman in Kentucky in the 1930s, and even rarer because she was a success. Back to our culture here, you know, those were the days when, you know, where the woman was, barefoot, pregnant, and in the kitchen. Well, she was in the kitchen, but she was selling hamburgers. And all this, and I don't mean to neglect the one thing, because I was fortunate enough, one of my mentors, you know, you go to law school, you learn some methods and such as that, and how to stand before the judge, but you really start to learn to practice law when you start practicing. Charles H. Reynolds was my first and best mentor. And that was Hilda's product. And his values, or her values, carried over very well with him. We'll say one thing about Charles. He, growing up, he had some good friends in Bowling Green. But he was an only child. And a little bit on the lonely side probably for that, and this is my analysis. He would never say that. So when he and Patty Nuss married, they had some children, in fact a football team size family, and I think that was a direct result of Judge Reynolds being an only child. Despite all of her success with her mashed potato money, Hilda was not an extravagant woman. She had one, it was almost her trademark, an extravagance, I guess we would say today. She loved Cadillac automobiles. And she traded and had a new Cadillac every year, always every year. And she made sure that her second husband, Marvin, the corporal, who was a professional man in civilian life, he had a Cadillac too. That reminds me of a story. The Cadillac dealer in Glasgow is Joe Goodman, and unless something's happened to him lately, he's still kicking around. Has a lot of Bowling Green connections. Lived at Ma Orr's boarding house here, Joe Orr's mother. And anyway, he sold, when she went, did the Cave City project, she moved up there. There was an apartment behind, she was a hands-on kind of manager. There's an apartment built into the restaurant and the cafeteria. And so she bought her Cadillacs from Joe Goodman. Well, there came a time after they were in Cuba that Joe got word that, and this was not a Cadillac for Hilda now, somebody in Cuba needed a Cadillac. And it was a very special model. So Joe Goodman said, he could handle that. The Glasgow Cadillac Agency gets into international trade. And so what happened, it was a gambling debt between somebody and Mac the Knife or one of these mob types down there. And the payoff was this Cadillac. And in those days, this was in the late 1950s, 58 or 59, you could almost have the Cadillac custom made in Detroit. So that was done. They delivered it in Glasgow, and trying to kill two birds with one stone, why, of course, Joe Goodman and Mrs. Goodman got in the car. We'll drive it to Miami and put it on the boat there, and we'll go over to Havana, and we'll sort of have a vacation. Well, Joe had driven most of the way down there, and he got a little sleepy. His wife took over. He trusted her to drive. Thought he was a really a good driver. Going down the road, and all of a sudden, sirens, you know. She pulled over, Joe woke up, oh, what's happened? And the officer came up to the window, and she said, "Officer, I know I wasn't speeding. I watch that all the time." And he said, "Oh, no, ma'am. I just wanted to stop you so I could look at this car." That was the kind of car it was. Joe, that was a close one. That's not in the book either. See, you all are two ahead now. I really did search for Montez, West Virginia. The railroad is long gone, and got back in those mountains and drove as far as I could and talked to these natives, and they said, "Yep, it's over about two ridges over that way, but there's nothing there." And what's West Virginia's expression, or wild and wonderful? It really is. And you talk about contrast there, Hilda's thoughts on West Virginia to going into the middle of the desert and being one of the founders of Caesar's Palace in Las Vegas. That takes a little imagination. Mike Reynolds and I made one trip to Las Vegas, and it's like everything we were doing, you know, Mike has a day job, and I had some commitments. We didn't get to stay long. But the highlight of the trip was talking to a fella, and our editor, he couldn't think up a fictional name any better than this: Beecher Avant. Now, Beecher Avant was the he was a detective, and he was commander of what I think they called it the Magnificent Seven, this elite detective force, and he is the one who solved the murder of Hilda Reynolds Krause. And he said it was kind of tough because when that happened, it was such a horrendous crime and an awful thing to happen, even in a community like Las Vegas. There were rumors of a bloody mafia takeover of the casino industry, all kinds of things like that, none of which was true. But Mike and I flew out there, and we interviewed Beecher Avant, a long time, several hours, and we learned that even before this crime that he was called upon to investigate, he knew Hilda. He knew her personally, and that's what made it so tough for him when he came on this scene and found her the victim of a throat cutting. He took us to the crime scene and did everything he could to fill us in on what was a pretty painful thing, especially for Mike to hear. But he was a real admirer of her. Back to the Bowling Green bus station, I had a note here. I've had so much help on doing really all of my books at the Kentucky Library at the Kentucky Building, Western Kentucky University. And for example, the old bus station was gone, but they've got an amazing catalog of photographs up there, a lot of them dating back into the early 19th century. And if you're looking for something genealogically or family-wise, or just interested in history of Bowling Green, Warren County, Kentucky, some things farther away than that. They fall over backwards, helping you find what you're looking for. Because of the passage of time, there are not a whole lot of people still around here that knew Hilda outside the family. And first person information was difficult to come by, but we got some of that. Julian Durbin was very helpful. I think that I've got a note here that if you were trying to put a label on Hilda, she defies labeling. But what I think of after I found out what the family had to say and researched what happened in Las Vegas and all this, she was the epitome of determination and tenacity. I only met her one time. I delivered a paper out to her that Charlie Reynolds wanted me to take out, and she signed it, and that was it. I never knew the lady. I wish I had. Edison said that all of his success was 98% or something perspiration and a couple of percentage points of inspiration, and that doesn't quite fit her. I don't know, the perspiration part probably hits 100% on its own, and she's one of these people that, you know, the football coach says, you got to give 110% tonight if you're going to do any good. Well, she's 110%er because she had not only the drive and the perseverance, but the intelligence to see her through on these projects. The other thing about it, I better look here and see how I'm doing here. The determination and tenacity, and I think the book points out that she was a person that would simply never give up. Like Winston Churchill, you know, never give up, never give up, never give up. I have slandered these people in New York, the editor and the agent wanted me to make up quotes that I didn't have. But I'll say one thing, and this probably improved the book. You always get something good out of it if you look enough. I'd written this sort of like a history book, you know, and I sort of had a little something on the front end. I'm going to tease them, well, there's going to be a murder, you know, and then went on down through all of her career and life, and then the murder was on the tail end. I said, you got to put that up front. And I did, and I think it probably made the book better, more readable. But, you know, living in this part of the country, you don't need a lot of imagination because per square inch, I believe that we've got as many characters and funny situations, geographical oddity, you name it. And we've got it here in South Central Kentucky. These characters, you know, one came to mind earlier today. I was with the Daily News during Bowling Green's experiment with Prohibition, 1957 through 1960. And that livened up the local news for sure. And there was a guy named Junebug, and he ran a Marshall Love knows Junebug and Hildreth and many others. Anyway, he ran a little operation out on the Slim Island Road, you know, beer and whiskey and anything else you wanted, and a bunch of slot machines. And I think there were 9 or 10 of them. State police raided there and confiscated the slot machines. And when you do that, then the circuit court has to declare those slot machines contraband or illegal or something before they can be destroyed. And that takes some time, to 90 days maybe. Meanwhile, they were stored in the basement of the Warren County Courthouse. And my good friend Maurice Lowe was Commonwealth attorney at that time, and he had alerted me to the raid on June bugs. And so I was out there with my speed graphic, and I had a picture of all these slot machines after the state police had confiscated them. Well, when they were going to destroy them, Maurice called me and said, "Well, we got the order. We're going to destroy those slot machines." I said, "Good. I get the speed graphic. I'll get a picture of this with their axes and, you know, so forth." Well, anyway, I took a preliminary picture. The 10 slot machines were sitting there. Took a picture of it. Developed it. And at that time, Chess Johnson Photo Center did all the photo engraving for the Daily News. But anyway, they furnished me with the 8x10 and the engraving. And I had the other 8x10 there. And I thought, well, I'm just, out of curiosity, I'll just look at these two and compare them. And 9 of the slot machines made sense. But the 10th, I'll never forget the name of it. I think it was a quarter machine. Wild Indian was the name of it. You know, it had the handle, the old-fashioned one, where you really had to work to lose your money. And anyway, what I found out, now how this could be done, who knows? We were never able to find out, but somebody had slipped into the evidence room and substituted a junker machine, one that wouldn't even work, you know, it was worn out, and taken the machine that was brand new and went off with it. The story didn't end there. We published that part of the story and said, "There's a wild Indian in the picture and something's wrong here." And then about a couple of weeks later, there were some mysterious phone calls made, and I went with our Commonwealth attorney Maurice Lowe, and we went out on the banks of Barren River, and under an oak tree, there was the missing machine. So anyway, it finally got destroyed. So there are plenty of characters, plenty of stories right here, and as the old saying goes, anybody sitting in here, you've got a book in you. You just have to look for it. And that the second book, Charles Garvin, of course, he was a gold-plated character from day one. I guess the bottom line, and I think that this is true. I do not know. After Justice Reynolds' unfortunate death, much later than that, because years after that, Mike and I talked and decided on this project. Now, if Justice Reynolds had been living, I think I can say for sure that this book would never have been written. He was just a very private person, and he was interested in his professional work and his family and his hobbies and his art collections and such as that, antiques. But he would not have welcomed a book such as this. But I think accomplished a goal, a portrait of a remarkable lady. She accomplished remarkable deeds. She was an entrepreneur and a very good mother. And I think that tells the whole story right there. We wanted to get beyond the murder mystery, and that's what we tried to do. We didn't want the horrendous murder to eclipse what she had accomplished in her lifetime. Now, I had one thing, and this just came in recently, and you're about through with me. This is a small picture. I don't know how. When Mike Reynolds and I were in Las Vegas, Beecher Avant was walking on a cane. He'd been in a traffic accident. And he really went to some lengths to help us with the story. He's much improved here. This is his girlfriend. And she sent me this picture. And this will just take a minute. Sort of look at that. Now, as you all look, pass that around and see if you can guess what this lady's occupation might be. I don't think anybody's gotten it yet, but once it gets around, I can maybe give you a clue. While they're doing that, how about a short commercial break? I'm working on somebody that most of you never heard of, Major General William Luther Sibert. He lived on McFarland's Beach Road, and he was a builder of the Panama Canal. He started his career on the Green and Barren Rivers in 1888 and put them back into shape. When he got here, you couldn't ride the steamboat from Evansville to Bowling Green. You would have to come as far as Rochester, get off the boat because the locks wouldn't work. They'd caved in. And you'd go walk around the lock and get on another boat and come on to Bowling Green. Remembering that that river was the major highway into south central Kentucky. There wasn't any I-65, there wasn't any, not even a 31W. The roads just were not there. And it was a major commerce stream along the Green and Barren River. So he ends up, after fooling with those little old locks on Green and Barren, he ends up building the world's largest dam and lock in Panama. I don't know. Maybe not. Maybe those Chinese have built one bigger, but I don't think so. You got to watch those guys.
We've got time for some questions, Bob.
Be glad to while they're questioning.
Let me start off by saying I was very intrigued by the fact that Hilda kept money in mayonnaise jars in both a number of locations and wondered whether she had a distrust of the bank.
I think this comes from being in the Depression, and she always wanted to have a reserve fund for whatever was needed. And you would think that she would be a first cousin of Charles Garvin, who, same deal, he came through that Depression, he buried money out at Beach Bend. Yeah, it was a rainy day fund, and she really did do that.
Do you think all of it was found, or is there still mayonnaise jars?
Hers is accounted for, except what might have disappeared from a lockbox over in West Virginia.
Yeah. Question over here.
I guess I put two occasions together. So I thought that big hotel fire was associated with their death, too.
Not that I know of.
What about movie rights? Have you been
talking? You have to talk to my agent, Mike Reynolds, on that.
I'd make a good movie.
That's just fine.
I've been glad to play a part.
back here, yes.
Yes, ma'am.
Where was the Cave Acres located at the cave?
It was located toward the north end of Cave City on US 31W on the left as you went up. About 600 feet of frontage on 31W when that was prime land for any kind of business. It was on the left. The building's no longer there.
Other questions? When we're talking about money, I'm really intrigued by this burying the money. One story you have is in Cave Acres, that they actually had to break through a wall to cover these jars. We're talking a lot, thousands of dollars? Or, I mean, what's a rainy day fund?
Well, let's just say it's a lot of money.
A lot of money.
You see, when she would do that, and then when this opportunity came along to invest in the hotel and casino de Capri in Havana, Cuba, the mashed potato money was there to do it.
She also had bank accounts as well, we presume, so this was just extra funds.
Sure. Oh, yeah. This was her savings account.
You didn't say much about Mr. Krause. Can you tell us a bit about him?
I'm not going to pass any moral judgments on Krause. He certainly got his wife in the big time as far as the casino business and the opportunity to be financially successful. But he was a womanizer, and therein lies the problem. And it was unfortunate, but that played into her death. And he wasn't responsible for that, not directly.
You talked about her as someone who had great character. And when she moved into the casino business, it must have been legitimate. And this was the way that she intended to make a lot of money. Then did that change? I mean, was she forced out of the business?
Yeah. She had an earlier investment in Las Vegas in the Riviera, which set the trend for the development of the Las Vegas Strip. But some guys with suits on came and said that we'd like to buy that. And again, remember, she was a minority owner, 4%, 5%, you know, that the same kind of percentage that Frank Sinatra had, Dean Martin, these stars, that was traditional to do that. And anyway, the big owners in that particular thing, they were scared to death, and they sold out. And she was forced out of that. She had to take her money and put it in the basement of Cave Acres, wait for the opportunity in Havana. And and of course, she was forced out of Havana by Castro, but bless his heart, she was the last one to go.
Well, if that picture has reached the end, I guess we'll have to answer the question.
Anybody have a clue as to what that lady's occupation is? What?
Waitress?
No. When she sent the email and when she sent me the email and ordered the book, she wanted a book for herself. What's that?
Was she the coroner?
No. Anyway, let me give you her email address, and you can probably put two and two together. Her last name's Corson, C-O-U-R-S-O-N, and her email address is Corson21Dealer.
Oh, she's the last one.
She sounded cute as she could be over the phone.
Well, if there are no further questions, now that time we're one more.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
From where she was born to Montez, the Elkins, West Virginia.
How far apart?
From Montez to where?
Elkins.
Oh, less than 10 miles, I would say. Yeah. But boy, you would think that you were, you know, in a jungle 1,000 miles away. Yeah.
And now, Peggy, a little token of our appreciation.
This has been, without a doubt, a fun evening from supper all the way through your talk, and we have loved your book. And especially this one, because of her association certainly with Bowling Green, but so many of us knew some member at least of the Reynolds family, and it just is like a little touch of home. So we hope with Churchill that you never give up.
Thank you, ma'am. I appreciate it.
Well, again, on behalf of our sponsors, the Friends Group of WKU Libraries and the Kentucky Museum, our genial hosts here at Barnes & Noble, I want to thank you especially for coming out on a very busy night for many of you. We hope you'll join us next week in our Faraway Places series here, where we'll be having Ann Jean Wilson and her husband, who will be talking about 50 years in the Peace Corps and what Kentucky has meant to the Peace Corps. And they've interviewed more than 100 Kentuckians who will be telling their tales. Next week and next month in the series, we'll have a very special visitor, Jerry Passon, who's now moved down to Hopkinsville Community College. We'll be talking about the role of the Corvette in literature and culture. Bob will be happy to sign copies of his book here at the end, and if you'd like to pay for them as you exit the building. Again, thanks and good evening.